In the meantime, there were one or two conversations. A lawyer representing Marcus Evans spoke to Michael about potential terms. Then I was asked if I'd go back down to London for another chat. Marcus was happy with how the first one had gone and just wanted to confirm his impressions. So I went back. I'm guessing it was a week or two later. Ipswich already had a manager at this time, Jim Magilton. I was being touted for a job that was already occupied. But I didn't feel too bad about that. It's not good, but it's standard practice. I thought it was all right to chat about the job. I hadn't agreed to take it. I didn't feel too sorry for Jim Magilton. I felt he'd let me down with a player when I was managing Sunderland. He was supposed to take Tommy Miller off me. We'd agreed a deal. The transfer deadline came. I can't remember which one it was. But Ipswich pulled out of the deal. I rang Jim Magilton. I said, "What's happening? I've turned down other deals for Tommy because you said he was going to you." He was proper aggressive. He didn't give a fuck. It was all fuck you and me back to him. Fuck you, you're a fucking joke. But it started at his end. So, part of me was thinking, fuck him. It's the business. I found out later that another manager spoke to Marcus Evans while I was still the Ipswich manager. Today, I don't think I'd do it. If a club offered me the job while the manager was still in place, I'd probably say no. But you know where I am. But it's like any other business. The club has to plan ahead. I was speaking to Ipswich while the manager was still there. But they'd approach me. And it was the first approach I'd had since Sunderland. Barcelona hadn't been ringing me. After the first meeting with Marcus Evans, I asked Tony Loughlin to go and watch an Ipswich game. They were playing in Bristol on a bank holiday Monday. I wanted to have some idea about them, in case I was offered a job. Tony went down to Bristol, bought a ticket like a normal punter, and watched them. He thought they were very average. I got the impression, after the second meeting with Marcus Evans, that the job could happen, as long as we could agree terms. 9 times out of 10, when a manager is out of work, he'll agree terms. A few days later, I was down there in the blue training kit, and I was looking at it, going, fucking hell. I didn't feel the excitement I'd felt going up to Sunderland. I'm not sure why not, but I didn't. I feel bad even admitting that. Tony Loughlin was with me again, but I didn't have that innocence. Oh, it's exciting. Maybe after the Sunderland experience, I was a bit wary. There seemed to be a bit of everything about it that wasn't quite right. The setup, my mindset, the location. But if things had gone better, I probably wouldn't be thinking that. Tony's job description was never assistant. He was always first-team coach. But he was working alongside me. But you're working with 20-odd players, so you need 2 coaches, at least, more voices, more support. At the time, I just had Tony. I didn't bring other people in quickly enough, straight away. Chris Kiwumia was there, and Brian Clogg, and Steve McCall was the chief scout. They'd all played for Ipswich. It had the feel of a family club that didn't need breaking up. But that was exactly what it needed. You need to bring in 3 or 4 people with you. Make your mark. And if you want to be cynical about it, if the manager's having a hard time, the club will stick with him longer, because it costs a lot more money to get rid of 4 or 5 people. We'll give him another few weeks. He might get that result. But I was the same at Sunderland on my first day. It was just me and Tony. But my eyes weren't lying to me. Some of the staff at Ipswich weren't up to it. There were 2 members of the medical staff that I disliked straight away, what they were doing, the way they worked. I didn't like the way they allowed players to behave in front of them. I didn't think they were professional or authoritative enough, but I kept them. To be fair to the owner, he told me that if I wanted to make changes, I should do it quickly. But I thought I'd wait till the summer, wait till pre-season. But maybe I'm just making loads and loads of excuses. That's management. Deal with all that. Eventually, into the season in November, I brought in Ian McParland, or Charlie as he's known. I met Charlie when I was doing my pro licence, He had managed at Notts County and he'd coached Forrest. I liked Charlie, but he could argue. He made me look like a saint. Tony and some of the other lads were fairly quiet, but Charlie made up for them, and me. Eventually, I brought in Antonio Gomez, the fitness coach from Sunderland. All these men are survivors. I hadn't been to the training ground before I took the job. There were stories later that when I took over, fans weren't allowed in, and that I'd changed the locks. Our first session was open to the fans, but nobody came. My first day, you'd have thought a couple of school kids would have been dragged in by your dad or granddad, but there wasn't one person watching. They didn't mind, but it seemed to say something. That warmth wasn't there. Then there was the blue training kit. I don't like fucking blue. Is that childish? That first day, myself and Tony went back to my office for a cup of tea. It was a cabin, like a school prefab. I'm not knocking that, but I just thought it all needed freshening up, a lick of paint. There were money difficulties at the club. I appreciate that. But myself and Tony sat down and looked at one another. I'm not sure about this one. I couldn't feel it. The chemistry. Me and the club. I get annoyed now, thinking about that. I should have been able to accept it. I was there to do a job. The biggest problem was, we won our first two games. The last two games of the 08-09 season. I started on the Wednesday or the Thursday, and we'd a game in Cardiff on the Saturday, 29th April. We were awful, but we won 3-0. Cardiff missed a penalty to go 1-0 up. They could have beaten us 10-0. I wish they had. Then I'd have thought, this is a rebuilding job, this. We had Giovanni Dos Santos on loan from Spurs. He played for Mexico in the World Cup in Brazil. What he was doing at Ipswich, I do not know. He was brilliant. He got us up the pitch and scored one of the goals. We won. The Messiah has arrived. The last game of the season was at home to Coventry. Marcus Evans told me during the week that they'd already covered my contract with season ticket sales for the next season. It was a dead rubber game. There was nothing at stake. But there were 20,000 people there. We won again. And we deserved to. I was thinking, we don't have to do too much here. And focus on the dressing rooms. Get them decorated. When I went up to Sunderland, they'd been relegated and they just lost their first five games of the season. The transfer deadline was in 3 days. I had to do things quickly, get people in who I knew and trusted. This time I started at the end of the season. The club was mid-table, and I won my first two games. So the urgency wasn't there. I wasn't walking into a crisis. If we'd lost the two games, I think I'd have been saying, listen, I'm going to be busy all summer. When the players came back pre-season, they found great dressing rooms. But I hadn't done enough with the team or the staff. I dropped my standards. After Sunderland, I thought that maybe I should step back a bit. I shouldn't be so intense. But at Ipswich, I fell into that trap of thinking, this'll do us. The staff, they'll do us. I should have been saying, they definitely won't do us. I should have brought in more people from the start. This is us. Things are changing. When I left Sunderland, it was my gig. When I left United, it was my gig. I fought my own little wars. At Ipswich, I fought other people's battles. I went with other people's standards. That was my biggest crime. The club's new chief executive, Simon Clegg, was an ex-para, and we had the idea that we'd have 1 or 2 days with the forces in Colchester pre-season. It was my idea, but Simon had the contacts. I was trying something a bit different. I thought it would break the monotony of pre-season training. Colchester is just down the road from Ipswich, so the players wouldn't be on a bus for 6 hours. We decided to surprise the players. We told them to be ready to go away for 1 or 2 nights. Typical footballers. I think some of them thought they were on their way to some 5-star hotel. We got to Colchester and experienced the training regime of the 7th Parachute Regiment Royal Horse Artillery. The plan was we'd stay in tents that night out in some woods after a series of marches. The intense part was in the evening. The paras are trained to live off the land, so we saw them slaughtering a pig. We had to watch. It wasn't nice. They cooked us, and we ate it. But the lads were cold. You're out of your environment, and you just want to sleep. I asked one of the officers to organise something for the morning to get the lads up and out quickly. So, at 5 or 6 in the morning, they woke us up with stun grenades thrown to the sides of the tents. That woke us up. Every time I saw a face sticking out of a tent, the expression told me, if you think we're getting promoted on this, you're in fucking trouble. They were running around and climbing things, and it wasn't like the local park. The staff joined in. I had an accident in one of the bars. I went to grab it, fell back and banged my head. I got no sympathy. Marches and breaks and setting up the tents. I don't think anyone was keen to share a tent with me, so I ended up with one of the paras. I slept with my Celtic top on. There was no sitting around the fire, the banjo out and the sing-song. Anyway, it wasn't the place to start singing rebel songs. It was hard. It was enjoyable, but the hotel might have been better. A lot of the lads ended up with blisters from the army boots. We had a friendly against Real Valladolid the following Friday, and one or two had to miss it because of the blisters. So the timing hadn't been great, although we won. It was good banter, but the lads were shattered. I don't think it created the bond or the spirit that I was hoping it would. Actually, you get that by winning football matches. And it wasn't as if I'd been there a few years and had a feel for the group of players. I was guessing at what they might enjoy, and I think I guessed wrong. The medical staff weren't happy. But I thought, fuck is, you better get used to living off the land anyway. Our first game of the new season was away to Coventry. We lost, 2-1. Giovanni De Santos had gone back to Spurs by then. Our keeper, Richard Wright, had been very good for my first two games at the end of the last season, but he cost us one of the goals, and a few more to come. It's so important to get off to a good start, and we played quite well. But we gave away 2 soft goals. John Walters scored for us. Teams can recover from a bad start, but a sluggish start often tells you what sort of season you're going to have. I really went overboard on the players after West Brom beat us 2-0, the 4th game of the season. It was over the top. West Brom had just been relegated, so they were going to be strong. I was playing a lot of young players. I was ranting and raving. You're all losers. It really wasn't my style. We'd lost to a better team, and normally I'd have accepted that. And it wasn't just because we were losing. We'd done that at Sunderland too. But things had taken off so quickly at Sunderland. I think I lacked a bit of patience with myself at Ipswich. I suppose I thought I could relive the Sunderland experience, but I couldn't get that momentum. I didn't feel I was bedding in. It was the 31st of October before we won a match, our 15th game of the season. Shane Supple was a goalkeeper, and he'd been involved in the first team. He was a really nice lad. He came to see me one morning in my office and told me he was retiring. He was only 22. The first thing I'd always suggest in a situation like that is for the player to have a break and come back in a week or so. The player might be a bit low, or he might have had an injury, or it's a family issue. I'd had my moments when I'd felt I'd had enough, but I could just tell by Shane's eyes that he'd made his mind up. He was cool about it. He wasn't upset. I remember saying to him, "You're not changing your mind, are you?" He went, "No. No, I've thought about it." He didn't love the game anymore, and he said he didn't want to work with people who didn't care if they won or lost. I think it was the whole industry that he disliked. I admired him for it. People often end up in jobs that they don't want, in places where they don't want to be. And I think, too, that the pull of Ireland was there. He wanted to go home to Dublin. I gave him the option of coming back, but I knew I was wasting my time. I think he was going back to Ireland to become a Garda, a policeman. So I thought to myself, I better keep on side with Shane. So that was one of our goalkeepers gone. Of the 14 games before we beat Derby on the 31st of October, 8 were draws. They were all bad draws. But the 3-3 draw at Doncaster in mid-September was a disaster. We were winning. We're 3-2 up going into injury time. And Quinton Fortune, ex-United, cuts in. I played with Quinton. And I never saw him use his right foot. But he hits it with his right and scores. Top corner. We've been 1-0 up, and 2-1 up, and 3-2 up. 10 days later, we draw 3-3 with Sheffield United. The same story. They scored in injury time. 6 goals, 2 points. At that stage of the season, the 4 points we dropped would have sent us up 10 places in the table. 20 draws in one season. It's still mind-boggling. And we had been winning so many of those games. I should have used the substitutions better. Get an extra defender on. But I thought, it's only Doncaster. And they equalised. We'd have been better off losing 10 of those draws and winning 10. We'd have had 10 more points. Those 10 days between Doncaster and Sheffield, we were nearly there. But we never really had the exhilaration of 2 wins in a row. A run of results. We didn't get the momentum or the self-belief that comes with it. Newcastle came to Portman Road. They hammered us 4-0. It shouldn't have hurt so much. They had Andy Carroll. They'd Nolan. They'd Nicky Butt. A blind man would have got Newcastle promoted that year. But I was ex-Sunderland. The Newcastle fans travelled in numbers. There was the tribute to Bobby Robson. It was on TV. But Newcastle weren't coming to town every day. You wouldn't have looked at us and said, they're not even trying. There wasn't chaos. We didn't play particularly well when we beat Derby. We played Watford one night. We had 26 chances, but we drew 1-1. They scored in injury time. Another bad draw. We were nearly a decent team. The family had moved down with me and we rented a house. I liked the sea air. But we moved house 3 times in the first year. It was unsettling. But we were trying to find the right village. And villages can be funny old places. We couldn't find a Catholic school like St. Bede's in Manchester for the kids. The school we eventually found was different. It was more conventionally English, very middle class, cricket and rugby, tea and scones. We went to a charity function for the school a few months after the kids had started there. It was a tuxedo job, and I ended up sitting beside a man I didn't know. I wondered how the conversation was going to flow. He said, "What do you think of this new coalition government?" I thought, for fuck's sake. I nearly went, "Is there a new coalition government? Did you watch Barcelona last night?" I thought the new coalition was a team playing in the Suffolk League. I think I missed St. Bede's more than the kids did. And the blue kit, it always felt a bit wrong. Simon Clegg, the new chief executive, came on board the same day I started. Chemistry again? It wasn't there. He'd been the chief executive of the British Olympic Association, but he wasn't a footballing man. And I think it had more to do with the differences in our backgrounds. As well as being an ex-para, he was public school educated. I was from Mayfield in Cork, but I had to grow up. I couldn't expect to be working with Irish people. But the conversation has to flow. I'd say, I'm interested in that player. He'd say, well, what do I do? He'd never been involved in football before. I think he was all about being answerable to Marcus, not helping the manager. Everything was hard work. Most championship clubs lose money. Simon suggested a restructuring of the player and staff bonuses. Even as a player, I'd always thought that you should only really get a bonus if you'd earned it. The idea was that the bonuses would be delivered with a promotion or in reaching the playoffs. Normally, a player would get a bonus for a win or a draw. The average player at Ipswich would have been on 8 or 9 grand a week, so holding the bonuses, 300 or 400 quid a game, till the end of the season was a big incentive. One big sum instead of small amounts. The players were okay with the bonus restructuring. They were already sitting on 8 or 9 grand a week. But the staff were also affected, and they wouldn't have been on the same kind of money. The bonuses were a bigger thing for them. I now realise that the staff bonuses are vital for morale. I didn't comprehend that at the time. But people need incentives. It's human nature. Everyone loves a bonus. When a club has a win at the weekend, the training ground is a much happier place the following week. And the big reason for that is because the staff were all getting their bonuses. But that was gone. A bit. And we could tell quite early in the season that we weren't going to be promoted. So there'd be no bonuses. I should have left the staff alone. A couple of hundred quid a win. That money was a night out with their wives or a treat for their families. Success and the bonuses affected the families, made them part of the club. But I was taking something away, and they were obviously going to think less of me. It was stupid. I must have lost some of them before the season had even started. Some of the players, they were very quiet. We didn't have a Dwight York. We didn't have the characters. I needed some new players. I talked to the owner over the phone, gave him a ballpark figure. Tomas Priskin was at Watford and available. The scouts were keen, and I watched him once pre-season. He scored, played well, but it was a friendly. His contract was up in a year, and I thought he might be worth a punt. I think I mentioned a figure of 400,000 to the owner. I rang Malky McKay, who was managing Watford. "Listen, Malky, I'm just giving you a heads up. We're interested in a player." I never spoke to other managers about a fee for a player. I never get involved. Malky goes, "Right, I appreciate the call." I said, "I'm leaving it to the chief executive." I couldn't believe it when I heard what we paid for him. I think it was 1,750,000. Watford couldn't believe their luck. That was our lack of communication, the fact that the three of us never spoke together. Priskin wasn't worth that money, but nobody had got back to me to get my opinion. I brought in two of the lads from Sunderland, Carlos Edwards and Grant Ledbetter. They were good lads, but we paid too much for them. I thought about 2 million for the two of them would have been decent, but we paid just less than 4. I phoned Steve Bruce, who was managing Sunderland. I said, "I can't believe how much you're getting for Grant and Carlos." Brucey went, "Oh, no, Roy. They've agreed a deal." It had nothing to do with him. He was never going to say, "No, no, you're paying too much." The deal had been between Simon and Niall. I liked the look of Jordan Rhodes. He scored at Brentford for us pre-season, and he scored at home to Colchester. A couple of clubs rang me about him, Notts County and Huddersfield. It wasn't Liverpool or Arsenal. I brought a few lads in, and I'd been told that some lads would have to go out. I still get criticised for selling Jordan, and I have to accept that. But it was also a club decision. We sold him to Huddersfield, down a division, for 350,000, and he started scoring loads of goals. I think I was the one who suggested a sell-on clause, and thank God we had it, because they sold him to Blackburn for 8 million. The mistake myself and the staff made with Jordan was we discussed what he couldn't do instead of what he could do. I knew Lee Martin a bit from my playing days at United, but he didn't work out. He was a decent player, but the championship is about good, strong characters. I don't think Lee had that quality for the championship. Priskin too, technically, wasn't bad, but I don't think he worked hard enough. My recruitment wasn't good enough. I have no excuses. Damien Delaney came in and did okay. I was a bit hard on him sometimes, probably because I knew him and he was from Cork. That went over the top. I was the same with another lad, Colin Healy. He was from Cork too, and I told him he was moving his feet like a League of Ireland player. It was wrong. Colin was new to the club. I should have been bending over backwards for him. At Ipswich, I sometimes said the wrong things. Maybe I was trying too hard. When you're a manager, people say you should never worry about the players liking you. It's about them respecting you. But we all want to be liked. You don't want the people you work with disliking you. Maybe, after the Paris experience and bringing a few lads in and letting the wrong lads go, I was trying to right a few wrongs. We were playing away to Cardiff on the 29th of November, a Sunday. We'd beaten Derby, and since then, we'd had two more draws. I saw that there was a rugby match on in Cardiff the day before our game. Wales were playing Australia. And I liked the rugby, so I thought, well, I fancy going. How can I justify going down to Cardiff a day earlier? I decided I'd bring everybody. I rented a box at the Millennium Stadium, and we had a great day. I paid for it. Staff, players, we all walked up to the stadium together. It was brilliant. There's always a friendly atmosphere at rugby matches, so we weren't having to tell the players to watch their backs. It wasn't a football match we were going to, and it wasn't Ireland against England. The food wasn't ideal for the day before a match. Mashed potatoes, sausages. But we got stuck into it. They should have been having pasta. But I just thought, we've been doing that for 3 months, and we haven't been getting the results. We just had a really nice day. Maybe if we'd lost the day after, I'd have blamed all the mash and sausages. But we went out and we won. Did we win because of the rugby? Probably not. But the players appreciated it. I don't think they saw it as me trying to ingratiate myself or to win hearts and minds. There'd been photographs for the local paper and the match programme at the end of the Paris experience, and I remember thinking, maybe there shouldn't be. But at the rugby, there was no photographs, no fuss, no media stuff. It brings back good memories. They were a good group of lads. We won, but I didn't think of it as a turning point. I still knew it was going to be one of those seasons. When you don't win for the first 14 matches, it's not all down to bad luck. There were just too many draws. We couldn't finish the job off. But the signs were better after the Cardiff match. We started to win a few games. In December, we won 2, drew 2, and lost 1. The 2 draws were both 0-0, one after the other, away to Bristol City, at home to Peterborough. At Bristol I played Pablo Cuniago, a player I didn't particularly like or get on with. He was a striker, very talented. He had a chance with about 5 minutes to go. We had a shot, the keeper parried it to Pablo. He was 10 or 11 yards out. He took 3 touches and the keeper blocked it. He could have hit it first time. There are games that sum up your spell at a club. And that was the game. I remember people saying to me about Pablo, he's really no good to you away from home, and he doesn't always fancy it at home. That wasn't a good start, because half of your games are going to be away from home. I had a dig at him after the match. Fucking hell, Pablo. You've got to do that first time. He was, oh, this and that. Missing a chance like that is a reflection of the attitude of training. The first day pre-season, Pablo walked off the training pitch feeling his groin or something. It wasn't from a tackle, because the players had just been running and stretching. After we'd finished, I spoke to him. He'd been at home in Spain for the last 6 or 7 weeks, and he landed back in England at 11:30 the night before. I didn't think that was great. The next day, the second day of pre-season, I was in my office and I saw Pablo chatting to some of the players in the car park at about 9:10. He was due to have treatment, and the injured lads would have been in at about 8:30 or 9. So I called him in. I knocked on the window. I said, what are you doing? It's 9:10. And he went, oh yeah, but we just kind of do what we want. I said, well, them days are over. My days with Pablo were numbered, but he stayed at the club for another year because we couldn't move him on. No club was interested in taking him. And I was happy to tell him that. I just found him dead lazy. But he did get an important goal for me. We beat Coventry at home 3-2, and Pablo scored the winner in injury time. But that really was the only time he produced. I'm not a big fan of judging players from DVDs, but I watched a few Ipswich matches on DVD before I took the job. There was one. Pablo came on as a sub. He walked onto the pitch. He was so lackadaisical. He looked like he was going down a coal pit for 10 hours. Ipswich got a penalty, and he missed it. I thought, that's what you get for walking on. You're supposed to run onto the pitch like it means something. I didn't like the attitude of two or three of the players, including Pablo early on, which didn't help the flow of my message. I don't mind disagreements. I don't have a problem with a player having a bad time or playing badly. But the attitude to training, or the impression that the player is just there to pick up his wages, that's what will get to me. Ben Thatcher, one of the senior players, seemed to have issues with me. I heard that Ben was commuting a good distance. He was coming to work from London. I questioned him on that, and he was like, "Ah, yeah, I stay the odd night." I could have accepted it if he and a few others had been coming in and training like madmen. I might have given them Mondays off or some arrangement like that. Management is give and take. But I was looking and thinking, you're not really giving me much. Ben came in 3 or 4 hours late one morning. There'd been a crash on the M25 or the M1 or something like that. He was in my office. No apology. It wasn't as if they were important players to me. They weren't. But it still created an atmosphere. The training ground is quite small, so there was a tension, even passing one of them in the corridor. You're thinking, you fecker. And they're thinking the same thing. To the argument, if the player isn't good enough, get rid of him, the reply is often, where? I want to move on. Well, I'd love to move you on, but there'll be no calls for you. I liked Conor Wickham. He didn't score loads of goals, but he was only 16 or 17. He got kicked out of his digs one night. We'd a game. I think we were up at Scunthorpe, and they got a call. Conor had been evicted because he'd left his phone charger plugged in all night without the phone connected to it. I had to meet the academy manager, Sammy Morgan, a couple of days later. We discussed phone chargers for a few hours. I had a go at him once or twice. Sometimes I didn't like his attitude to training. He was a nice kid, though he was 6'3", a big, strong boy. He shook our hand properly. I'd shake hands with all the players as they went out to the pitch. Good luck, the usual. Sometimes I'd wonder what they were putting in my hand. But Conor would grab my hand, and I knew he'd have a go for me. He played in the toughest position if you're learning your trade in the Championship. He was a striker. And most of the centre-halves are big, experienced men, and they're going to leave their mark on you. But Conor would take it all day, and he'd be knocking lads over. He did well for me in some important games, and I'd like to see him scoring at Sunderland, where he is now. The crowds, always around 20,000, were good for a team that was lingering near the bottom. There were 25,000 there when we beat QPR 3-0, and the fans were decent to me. I could see the frustration and understand it, but what helped, strangely, was the draws. It's hard to hammer your team when they're drawing all the time, not losing. We recovered quite well in the second part of the season. We won more games. We beat QPR away and Sheffield Wednesday away. We beat Barnsley. We beat Reading. We won more games. We drew away to Newcastle. The last game of the season, we lost 3-0 to Sheffield United at Portman Road. There's a tradition that players go back out onto the pitch and say goodbye and thanks to the fans. They often have their kids with them. John Walters was our captain, and he was organising it. I made another mistake. I wouldn't go out with him. We'd been beaten. We'd had a player sent off, which didn't help. And we'd had a bad season. But I should have gone out. I should have stood with the players. If I'd been a player and the manager had said, "I'm too embarrassed to go out," I think I'd have thought, "You cunt." I'm not that type of person. It's not my form. But sometimes my actions are not what I would want. I should have gone. I'll go out with you lads. I'd always been okay at facing the music.
I should have looked at the table at the end of the season. We finished 15th out of 24 and said, that's not too bad. We were 14 points from a playoff place and 9 from relegation. I should have kept my head. I should have looked at the bigger picture. I don't think I'm a bad manager, but at Ipswich, I managed badly. But all the people I've admired, they've all had difficult spells, so I probably learnt more at Ipswich than I did at Sunderland. In the second season, 10-11, it was all about playing the younger players and getting the wages down. My job description had changed. It had been about promotion. Now, it was about working within a much smaller budget. During the summer, I'd had the dreaded conversation with the owner, where I was sitting in my office discussing tactics with him. We had a tactics board with us. I should have known my days were numbered. Well, why can't he play there? Because he's this, and he's not that. He said, let's go with the young players. I said, I don't mind going with the young players, but the championship will eat them up. The championship isn't a league for young players. You need a mix of young players and experienced men. Every manager who's been at Ipswich since, Paul Jewell, Mick McCarthy, they've gone for experienced players. The average age of a promoted team is 28 or 29. Kevin Kilbane came down for talks, and Sean Derry. His contract was up at QPR. Sean said, right, I'd love to be able to play for you. I said, Sean, I think I'll only be able to give you a year, and the money wouldn't be great. He said, no, I'd like to come and play for you. This was at the end of the first season, and it would have been a great start to the new season to have a good, experienced pro in the dressing room. But the club never offered him a deal. I was on holiday with my family a week later, on safari in South Africa. I was looking at some elephants when I got a call from Sean's agent. Your club's not been in touch and offered a deal. I was embarrassed. I couldn't believe it. I rang Simon. What's happened with Sean? He wants to sign. It's only a 1-year deal. He said, no, we're not going ahead with it. The warning signs were there. Lee Carsley came, but the club wouldn't offer him a contract. Kevin Kilbane, the same. These were good, experienced players and good guys. Kevin told me, Rye, your club's not even got back to me. I rang Simon, and he rang Kevin to apologise. This was a man who'd played more than 100 times for his country, and they couldn't even ring him to tell him they weren't going to offer him a deal. They would all have been free transfers. So, I gave 8 players from the academy their debut. 7 of them weren't good enough. I got in 1 or 2 loan players. We stayed local pre-season. Our thinking was, we'd play weaker teams, win a few games, build up confidence with a few harder games thrown in. So we played Histon, Great Yarmouth and Hadley United, and West Ham and PSV Eindhoven. Charlie McParland had left, for family reasons. He'd been commuting from Nottingham. And I asked Gary Ablett to come in as first team coach. I'd played against Gary, and I'd met him when I was doing my pro licence. I liked him. He'd played at big clubs, Liverpool and Everton. He'd managed at Stockport, and he'd managed the young players at Liverpool. He had the personality to go with the qualifications. Gary arrived in time for the trip to PSV. We lost 1-0. PSV were very good. I gave the lads a night out in Amsterdam. 2 of them were late for the bus the next morning. I'd warned them, lads, act like men tonight. If you're having a few pints, make sure you can get up. But of course, there were 2 stragglers. I fined them. A club fine could be a few grand, but my fines would be smaller, 300 or 400 quid, cash. And I explained to the players that the money was going into a kitty for, say, the Christmas do or go-karting trips for the players or staff, or a few quid for the groundsman. The lads were happy enough to pay the fines when they knew where the money was going. The policy, staying local, except for the short trip to Holland, worked a treat. I went to watch our reserves play at Tottenham 11 at home. Pablo Caniago came on for 10 minutes, and he was fucking awful. He should have passed the ball to a striker who was in a good position with about 5 minutes to go. I went down to the dressing room after the game and had a go at him. I said, "You should have fucking passed it." And he went, "Well, how are we going to win anything with you as the manager?" I nearly physically attacked him, but I didn't. Gary hadn't felt well when we were in Holland playing PSV. I remember myself and the other staff getting into him. "Are you homesick for Liverpool, Gary? Are you missing all the burnt-out cars and shell suits?" It was all friendly banter. And Gary was, "I don't feel too well." He didn't come into work for a few days. He got ill very, very quickly. He was staying in a hotel not far from where I lived, and we got the club doctor in to see him. Within a day or two, he was in the cancer ward in the hospital in Cambridge. He had non-Hodgkin lymphoma, a form of blood cancer. He was fighting for his life. He never worked again. Because he'd come in pre-season and there were still people on holiday, Gary's contract hadn't been finalised and signed, and although we'd agreed the package, the club wasn't legally bound to do anything. I rang the LMA, the League Managers Association, and said, "You'll have to come and help one of my staff." But Gary wasn't a member. But, still, they were brilliant. They made sure he got all his entitlements, and the club had to honour the deal. I had a meeting with the staff to explain how ill Gary was. I was very emotional. I remember thinking, "I'm not really ready for this. But who is?" I don't think I handled it very well, but I'm not sure that an older man would necessarily have handled it better. Gary was in the process of writing a book. It's very good. And he told me he was convinced that the pressures of football had taken their toll on him. He'd had a hard time at Stockport, financial problems, transfer embargoes. The stresses and strains had damaged him. I drove down to Cambridge after training to see Gary. Eventually, he was moved up to Christie's Hospital in Manchester so he could be nearer his family in Liverpool. I'd take my staff up to see him, or I'd see him at his house. He'd been planning to start giving talks on his career and the pressures of the game. That was going to be his project, because getting back on the training pitch was going to be very difficult. But he never got the opportunity. He died 16 months after he'd been diagnosed. I was on holiday in Mauritius when I heard the news. I'd gone from Ipswich by then. It was shocking. We had a great start. 3 wins against Middlesbrough, Palace and Bristol City, and 2 draws, Burnley and Portsmouth. We were third. I was delighted. We were taken off. We had a settled team. We were playing one up front and hitting teams on the counter-attack. It worked really well against Middlesbrough. A week later, mid-September, we were second after we beat Cardiff City. But we'd lost 3 players. I had a bust-up with John Walters. He wanted to leave. We were 4 or 5 games into the season. He'd heard that Stoke were interested in him. Tony Pulis again. He hadn't been in touch with me about the player. I said, "John, I haven't had a call from anybody." I couldn't blame John for wanting to leave. He'd been a good player for us, and he had a chance to go to the Premiership. But he did it the wrong way. He came back a few days later. "They're definitely after me." I said, "I've heard nothing. If there's a bid, I'll tell you. I've nothing to hide from you. You can ring the owner. I don't do the business deals. I'm not having this." There was effing and blinding and a bit of shoving. "Why don't you fucking believe me?" I didn't begrudge him the move, although I was losing one of my better players, and maybe my job. I got carried away, and John got carried away. I dropped him for the next game against Burnley. We were 1-0 up when they scored in injury time. At the press conference after the game, I said that John would never play for the club again. That was a big no-no. His value was down already. He was sold to Stoke a week later. It could have gone better, but I played my part. We've shook hands since. I came in one morning. Where's John Stead? Oh, he's gone for talks to Blackpool. Nobody told me about it. A week later, he was talking to Bristol City. I rang Simon. He said, oh, I wasn't sure if I should tell you. So, John Walters, John Stead and Alex Bruce had left. John Walters in particular was a big loss. We had a couple of injuries to important players, Gareth McCauley and David Norris. The players I'd wanted, Kilbane, Derry and Carsley, would have been vital to us now. We got a keeper, Asmir Begovic, unknown from Portsmouth, but only for 6 games. I hadn't really seen him play, but just by the way he walked into the building, I liked him. He lifted the training ground. We were unbeaten in the 6 games he played, but Portsmouth called him back. I think David James was injured. Asmir's at Stoke now, and he played for Bosnia and Herzegovina in the Brazil World Cup. They let me bring in Martin Fulop, another keeper from Sunderland. I wanted to bring him in on loan. I said, a loan deal all day. But the owner rang and told me that they'd done a permanent deal. I think it was for £750,000. I said, you know why they did a permanent deal? They obviously wanted him out the door. I brought in Mark Kennedy from Cardiff, but he was injured most of the time. Jason Scotland came in from Wigan, but he didn't pull up any trees. And he only arrived after John Walters and John Stead had left. He hadn't been part of any plan for the season. I was looking for players on loan. I tried to call in a few favours from a few old teammates, but I wasn't getting it back. I did get Andros Townsend and Jake Livermore from Tottenham. But in 2010 they were very young, and having Tottenham tendencies in a place like Ipswich is never good. They were young lads coming in with other young lads, all of them on small wages. We got Jack Colback from Sunderland, but then Steve Bruce needed him back for a cup tie. Sunderland were playing Notts County. I said, you're bringing him back for Notts County? He said, ah yeah, we need him. Notts County beat them. In mid-November, we lost 6 on the spin. Derby, Barnsley, Hull, Norwich, Swansea, Preston. We were down to 18th. We beat Leicester 3-0 and had 2 games postponed because the pitches were frozen. We drew at Coventry on New Year's Day. Then, 2 days later, we lost to Forest 1-0 at home. We weren't bad. We played well, but we lost. An own goal. Damien Delaney. A player who I was maybe quite hard on. That was me out the door. We were struggling. We were 3rd from the bottom of the table. But the call still surprised me. I didn't see it coming. I was sitting at home the next afternoon, and the owner rang me. I'd lost my job. I rang Charlie McParland. He'd come back to the club after Gary became ill. I told him the news and he went, oh, I knew we'd be gone today. I said, I didn't. I was really hurt by it. Not far from distraught. But you hide it. I was hurt from a family and pride. I always felt that I'd left United on my terms. It had been my decision. I could have stayed. I was still under contract. When the manager said, I think we've come to the end, I could have said, no. I don't think we have. I was shown the door, but I opened it and walked through. With Sunderland, I fell out with the owner. I thought leaving was right, but I was getting the sack this time. That hurt, and I felt I hadn't really made a good go of it. I did the school run. I picked the kids up. I went home to tell my wife. She was holding an envelope. That was put under the door while you were up at the school. Someone had dropped it off from the club. The termination of my contract. I didn't mind the phone call, but the letter, I thought, you fuckers. I didn't mind the owner ringing me. Even today, I'd have time for him. In his industry, I'm sure he has to do it all the time. I was another sacking. Within 48 hours, my conversation with my family was, let's get out of here. We bought a house, and we'd renovated it. But I wanted to get back up to Manchester. Our house there had been up for sale, but luckily we still had it. We moved back up 1 or 2 months later. When we got back in the house, kids back in St. Bede's, their old school, I felt like I'd been in a coma for the last 18 months. I wished it had never happened, but it had. Your pride is hurt. It didn't work out. It could have worked out. One story sums up my time at Ipswich. I had to go to my first shareholders meeting after 4 or 5 months in the job. Marcus Evans was the major shareholder, but there were others, so I went, shirt and tie. We'd had a poor start to the season, but I was told not to worry about the meeting. It would be very straightforward. The media man told me, "Don't worry, Roy. There might be a bit of Q&A. They're quite low-key around here. They might just ask you about the programmes or the pies." They'd gone through the financial aspects of the club, and there were thanks to Marcus Evans for his backing, and they noted that the academy was doing well. "Any questions from the floor? Pass the mic down." The first question was, "My name is such and such. I think Roy Keane should resign immediately from his position as manager of this football club." I felt like saying, "Can you give me till tomorrow, pal? I'd only been in the door 2 minutes." My biggest failing has been recruitment. Whether the problem was with my relationship with the scouts, or whether I brought in the wrong characters, ultimately, your signings will make or break you. I sold Jordan Rhodes, a goal scorer. Did I take the wrong advice? I wondered sometimes, are they listening to me? I should have followed my own gut feeling. Ideally, now, I'd like to watch players a bit more. I'd focus on what a player is good at, instead of talking constantly about what he can't do. I also have to remember that Ipswich hadn't done much before I arrived, and they haven't done too much since. I didn't take Barcelona to the bottom of La Liga, and to go over at Ipswich, and we went back a bit. Self-pity kicks in too easily. I was only gone a week when Ipswich played Arsenal in the first leg of the League Cup semi-final. I'd said that too many young lads would get eaten up in the championship. But the young lads had done very well in the League Cup. We beat Exeter away after extra time, Crewe away, Millwall away, Northampton at home, West Brom. Roberto Di Matteo got the sack within 2 weeks of that game, after a 3-0 defeat at Manchester City. Then we were drawn against Arsenal, two legs in the semi-final. Ipswich beat Arsenal in the first leg. It was the first time they'd been in a cup semi-final in 30-odd years. I trust myself a bit more now. At Ipswich, I'd be talking to a member of my staff, and I'd have to remind myself that I played more games at the highest level. I'd managed at a higher level, and I was taking advice from people who couldn't match that experience. That's not to say they're not worth listening to. I don't mean that. But don't underestimate yourself. The talk is constantly about players. The players you want. "I think he's brilliant. I think he's great. I think he's good. I think he's bad. He might be available. He mightn't. I think he's a great lad. I think he's a cunt." We were at a reserve match, and I said, "What do you think of the boy Iverson?" And two of the staff said straight away, "Nah." It had pissed me right off. I came in the next day, and I pulled the two of them. "Lads, the next time I mention a player, don't fucking dismiss him without considering it first." You get the experience by making mistakes, so again, I have to go easy on myself. Ancelotti, Van Gaal, they learn from experience. I would try and enjoy it a bit more. I'd try and be myself a bit more. I think the pressure of being the boss made me play up the role. There is a role, of course. I played it when I was a player. But I had more control of it. I was out on the pitch. It was easier. As a manager, you want the players to play for you. Ancelotti can manage Real Madrid and be a good guy. If I come up short, I can at least say, well, I was myself. At Ipswich, I acted a bit. It was a sleepy town, and I was, I'll fucking rock this place. I'll bring them to the army. We'll eat fucking pigs all night. It backfired, a bit. I made the point about Ellis Short talking to me like I was something on the bottom of his shoe. I think I spoke like that to some people at Ipswich. Paul Jewell came in after me and immediately said, oh, I'll have to fix this mess. It wasn't a mess. We were well organised. We trained properly. He brought in people like Jimmy Bullard from Hull. He was on about 20 or 30 grand a week. It happens. There's trust in a new manager. For a while. 11. I was a reluctant pundit. That attitude helped the quality of my commentary, I think. I tried to talk as I played, very simply. I sometimes saw Adrian looking at me, letting me know, we need more. And I was, you're not getting more. I've said my bit. I don't think I've ever used the word unemployed to describe myself. I don't want the label, and it's one of the reasons I started doing things that I wasn't so sure about. PR events, sign-ins, charity matches. They could be a fill-in and bring in a few bob. They'd fill my soul a little bit. I didn't want to sit around waiting for the calls to start coming in. There's an element of shame in doing nothing. I know, it's often not a choice. But for me, it was. When I left Sunderland, I thought I'd achieved enough to get another job. After Ipswich, I thought, I've not done enough to carry me into another job. Get ready for the worst. People say, when one door shuts, another one opens. But that's not always the case in football. One door shuts, they all shut. I never thought for a minute that my phone was going to be red hot. I was eventually offered an international job, and I spoke to a Turkish club. But it didn't feel like the right opportunities. I also spoke to a Premiership club and a Championship club, and I didn't hear anything back. I heard a college professor in his 50s tell a group of students not to worry about what they were going to do with their lives. I don't know what I want to do yet. I like that. It gave me hope. I ended up in Nigeria, doing a gig for Guinness, in September 2011. Guinness VIP got in touch, through Michael Kennedy. A big lump sum was offered. I'd be away for 3 or 4 days, and I'd be going with Marcel Desailly. I asked myself, do I want to go down this route? And I thought, well, I've got nothing else on, and I've never been to Nigeria. I was being warned. The money is good, but there are a lot of kidnappings out there. When my wife and kids heard about that, they were keen for me to go. There'd be nobody paying the ransom. I thought, I'll try it. I'll see if I can enjoy it, or appreciate it. I went to London, to a hotel at Heathrow, and met the middleman. There's always an agent involved. I can't remember his name. He introduced me to Marcel. I hadn't met him before, although I'd played against him. We had a good chat, a bit of banter. I liked him. We flew out to Lagos the following day. It was a nightmare getting through security at the airport. Proper chaos. You look at a movie scene set in an African airport and you say, it can't be that bad. But it was. We had security lads looking after us, and they got us through. The gig was called Guinness VIP. You were on a stage, but it was intimate. 100 people, maybe a touch more, sitting around us. You could turn and engage with people. And there was a live internet link-up. The first question was about what we'd both been doing since we'd retired from football. I wasn't that long out of the game. So they passed me the mic and I told them that I'd been doing a bit of travelling and I'd tried my hand at management. But the only face they saw up there was Roy Keane, Manchester United. They weren't seeing Sunderland or Ipswich. When we'd been called up on stage, they listed off our honours. Mine aren't too bad.